The following is a rebroadcast of Straight Talk About Money. The market data in this rebroadcast is not current and should not be used for any financial decisions.
We are very excited today to have Sheila Bair on with us this morning. Now, I can't give you the whole bio, but let me give you a little bit of her background. She was the 19th chairman of the Federal Deposit Insurance Corporation for a five-year term from June 2006 through July 2011. She had a tremendous career. She had an extensive background in banking and finance. Before joining the FDIC in 2006, she was Dean's Professor of Financial Regulatory Policy for the Eisenberg School of Management at the University of Massachusetts Amherst. But I love this. This is really, I was reading through this. When she was FDIC chairman, listen to this. In 2008 and 2009, Forbes magazine recognized Ms. Bair as the second most powerful woman in the world, and the only one that beat her was Angela Merkel, for God's sake. She runs the country. In 2008, she topped the Wall Street Journal's annual 50 Women's to Watch list. In 2009, she was named one of Time Magazine's Time 100 Most Influential People, awarded the John F. Kennedy Profile and Courage Award, and received the Hubert H. Humphrey Civil Rights Award. In 2010, she was featured on the cover of Time Magazine with Mary Shapiro and Elizabeth Warren as the new sheriffs of Wall Street. Fascinating. I mean, that's just, and it just goes on and on and on. We are really pleased this morning to have with us Sheila Bair. Good morning, ma'am.
Good morning. Thanks for that very nice introduction.
Oh, gosh, you have a great background. You really do. I wish I had more time to go into it, but thank you so much. By the way, you've written a great book. I don't have any more teenagers. Mine are 28 and 31, and so but it's a great, great book. Frankly, I think anybody ought to read this book. And I just wanted to start out by asking you, why did all this happen? Why did we have 2008?
Well, it was really a problem of short-sightedness, greed, and that translated into borrowing a lot of money to try to make short-term profits. And that was true of banks. Financial institutions were way too levered, which means that they were borrowing too much money. We had several households, too, that borrowed too much money. Some of them knowingly were speculating in the real estate market. Others, I think, probably most, were a victim of ever-increasing home prices that were being fed by this speculative frenzy, combined with some very complex mortgages that were very aggressively pushed on middle and lower income families that had very steep payment reshocks, and that's one of the reasons why we started having so many mortgage defaults when home prices started to turn. But it was borrowing too much and short-sightedness, greed and short-sightedness.
Absolutely, and they were really selling it to the general public, because I remember seeing no doc loan advertising where you didn't have to come up with the needed documentation, which was a real shock to me. Now, you know, I know you wrote this book for the younger set, but I think most of the parents out there don't understand either. I certainly don't. And I want to ask some very basic questions. What is a term that we hear a lot? In fact, we're hearing it again recently, too big to fail. What is too big to fail?
Well, too big to fail basically means that a large company, in this context, financial institution, most banks, if they got into trouble, if they became insolvent, you know, if you're a business or a household, you become insolvent, you're probably going to have to go into a bankruptcy process. But in this situation, if a large financial institution that's too big to fail becomes insolvent or nears insolvency, the government will come in and bail it out. It will lend it money, or it will make a capital investment. It will protect those who have invested from what otherwise would be an insolvency process that would impose losses on those shareholders and creditors. So that's basically what it is. It's the government saving people from their own mistakes by bailing them out as opposed to putting them into an insolvency process. And that's why we get back to the problem of too much borrowing, because when large financial institutions borrow too much money, and, you know, the rules now allow them to borrow $95 for every $5 of common equity that they raise to fund themselves, they can borrow $95. So for the business people listening, they understand that's a lot of leverage. You start having unexpected losses, it's not long before you become insolvent. So that is why too much borrowing makes it more likely that these big, too big to fail institutions will fail. And then the government will bail them out, which means that creditors and shareholders just don't care because they figure, okay, they're borrowing a lot, but who cares because the government's going to protect them anyway if they get into trouble.
Yeah, I mean, that, because that ratio 5 to 95, I believe that's even bigger than the ratio that caused us trouble with the Great Depression, I think, back then.
Oh, much, that, yes. Banks had a lot more capital in the lead-up to the crisis in 1929, the market crash, than they do now. Yeah, this very high level of leverage is actually a fairly recent phenomenon, and the big banks like to tell you, well, it's not, you know, we can't operate, we can't lend money if we can't have these really high levels of leverage, but historically they have operated with a lot more common equity and less debt.
Are we setting ourselves up for another one then? Another 2008?
Well, I don't know. I do worry. I mean, they have, is that 5 to 95 ratio, as bad as that sounds, it was... There was no what we call leverage standard for the big banks prior to the crisis. We had one in the U.S., but globally there was not one. And so the 5% is actually an increase from what we had before. So banks do have more capital now, but are they still borrowing too much? I think they are still borrowing too much. And I think the risks are arguably greater now. We've had this very aggressive monetary policy for many years, and that has created distortions, I think. I think it's inflated financial assets. Like, you know, people say, well, we don't have consumer inflation, which is what you worry about, consumer price inflation. When you worry about the Federal Reserve having very generous monetary policies, pumping a lot of money into the economy. But we do have financial asset inflation. We've had both stock and bond markets go up significantly. And I do worry about that there could be a correction there, and we could have unexpected losses again, this time financial assets, not home prices, and that could cause a problem. And no, I don't think the banks have enough capital to withstand those types of unexpected losses.
Yeah, there are a few economists out there saying that we're setting ourselves up for a big fall. One of them, in fact, is David Stockman. They're in the minority, and everybody laughs at them when they say that, but it sounds like there's a possibility. What is the argument to have too big to fail? I assume that when Jamie Dimon runs around Wall Street and runs around Washington, he can make an argument that too big to fail is a good thing. What would be the argument to continue this?
Yeah. Well, they've, I think that first you need to decrease the chance that they will fail to begin with. And you do that with a lot more, a lot stronger requirements that they fund themselves with less debt and more with common equity. So that's the number one. And the number two, I think you need to have a credible mechanism, bankruptcy-like mechanism, that if they do get into trouble, they will go into an insolvency process, just the way you and I would if we became insolvent, and that their shareholders and their creditors, just as our investors would take losses, that they will take losses too. If you can convince the market, the people who invest in their shares, invest in their debt, if you can convince them that their money's at risk, you will have a lot more market discipline on these big institutions, and that will cause them to downsize and become less risky. When bond investors are saying, well, why should I buy your debt? You know, I could lose a lot of money if you fail with these very thin capitalization levels. So I think that's really what we need to do. And in fairness to Jamie Dimon, I think he agrees as well that we need to have some type of an insolvency mechanism. But what he wants to do to get there, it may not be credible.
Well, at least he's thinking about it, because he's certainly
right.
A very, very powerful man in that arena. So
yes.
Anyway, I've got a dozen questions to ask you if you'll stay with us. Folks, we have a great show. We've got Sheila Bair with us today, former FDIC chairman. We'll be back in just a moment. You're listening to Straight Talk Money.
The following is a rebroadcast of Straight Talk About Money. The market data in this rebroadcast is not current and should not be used for any financial decisions.
We are talking about the crisis that so quickly got our attention and lasted for a long time. Believe it or not, even lasted longer than the Greece crisis in 2008. And we are speaking to a person who's an expert in that area. We have with us today former FDIC Chairman Sheila Bair with us this morning. And you heard me give you the introduction this morning, but one of the things is on August 1st, she becomes president of Washington College in Chestertown, Maryland, which I think is very, very exciting. Ms. Bair, I've been asking you questions, as I mentioned during the break, that people have asked of me over the years in this talk show. And one of the ones that they've asked is why didn't anybody go to jail?
Well, that is a good question, and we see even now after the crisis with these manipulation scandals of the interest rate, the LIBOR interest rate manipulation, foreign currency exchange manipulation, and these banks are paying multi-billion dollar fines. Their shareholders are, but in terms of people actually going to jail, there's not been much of that, and I think that's unfortunate because the best way to change behavior is to impose accountability. And a lot of these traders, I joke, a lot of these traders who do this, you can't lump everybody together, but certainly the kinds of personalities that were involved in these market manipulations, I think there's probably two things they understand. They understand jail or they understand impoverishment. But, they need one or the other or both. And they're not having to pay out of their personal pocket. They're not going to jail. And I think that's bad. They should be accountable, and also you're not going to change behavior unless you have those kinds of very severe consequences.
Absolutely, and there doesn't seem to be either one. In fact, there's been a lot of loss of confidence in the federal government, and I was reading your book. In fact, there's an interesting portion of your book in which you're talking about Washington Mutual, WaMu, and you mentioned in there that the OCC was trying to hang on to WaMu because it had lost the other two. There were three major institutions that it had, overseeing, and that that they had lost. They were trying to hang on to it, and it seemed to me like in reading that chapter, it was the OCC versus the OTS,
it was OTS actually that wanted to hang on. Yes, it was the OTS, which has been since been abolished by Congress. There's just a long history of the Office of Thrift Supervision, and before them, their predecessor agency, the Federal Home Loan Bank Board, as being very, very close to institutions that they regulated. I call it cognitive capture, but they just had a tendency to view the world through the eyes of the banks or thrifts that they regulated. And in this situation, yes, they only had most of their charters had been acquired by national banks or converted to national bank charters, which were regulated by the OCC. So WaMu was really the only large one they had left, and I do think that that skewed their judgment in terms of how sick that institution was.
Yeah. In fact, by the way, folks, and I apologize. The OTS is Office of Thrift Supervision. The OCC is Comptroller, Office of the Comptroller of the Currency. I shouldn't use those acronyms without explaining that. You also talk about it's just interesting. I love this book. You were talking about Citigroup, and you're talking about Vikram Pandit being put in there. He was a lousy hedge fund manager. In fact, they had to write off the hedge funds, I think, a year after they paid $800 million for it, and he made $165 million from it. But he got in there because he was a friend of, if I understand this, he was a friend of Robert Rubin. Robert Rubin was a friend of Tim Geithner, and everybody wanted to keep Tim Geithner happy, so they allowed this to happen. When you read this, you just kind of shake your head, and it really kind of comes down to the fact that people are losing faith, I think, or a lot of people are. I guess you can't use that broad of a brush, but so many people are losing faith in the government almost to the point they're just ignoring it. They just said, they're going to do whatever they're going to do. They're not paying any attention to us, so I'm just going to go about my life and try to hang on and do the best I can for me and my family because government isn't going to be there to help.
Yeah. Well, I think that's right, and it's not, I think, look, I'm a capitalist, I'm a markets person, but I want people to get jobs and be well paid because on the merits, because they have expertise and a track record that warrants the job that they, and that they're actually earning those big salaries, and I think that's where the disconnect is that the perception is these days that these jobs are allocated based on who you know, and a lot of that's, whether you have government connections and friends in the government who are going to help you out. It's called crony capitalism, and it's bad, and I think it's infecting our system more than it should. And it's not just, you can see it in energy, you can see it in healthcare. It's not just banks. This big fight over the Ex-Im Bank, I think, is partly about that. And those are manufacturers getting some nice, very large manufacturers getting some very nice taxpayer loan subsidies, arguably to enhance their competitive position. But What it really is gives us special favors that others don't have. And ironically, what you're subsidizing with XM is the foreign importer who is buying, it's Boeing or GE are the two that get the most of it, buying their goods. And that puts, people in the U.S. who are buying those goods at a competitive disadvantage because they don't get the subsidized rate. So I think it was very prominent during the financial crisis about how close, and in my view, inappropriate relations between banking and government had become. But this coziness is not just confined to banking. I think it's a real problem. And our corporate tax code is another area where you have a very high marginal rate, but it's only, it's the chumps that are paying for it. It's the small businesses or the people who don't want to try to game the system or can't afford the lobbyists. The big guys don't pay that. And it's unfortunate that hurts their productivity. That hurts their competitiveness. So I think this is a huge issue for the country, not just in banking, but the government generally.
Absolutely. Well, I have a question from a listener. And the listener requests, deposits in banks are now unsecured assets, according to the listener. Is this the action of the FDIC?
I'm not sure what they mean by unsecured asset. A deposit actually is a liability of the bank. It's like as if you're lending money to the bank. And the FDIC comes in and says, on that loan, up to $250,000, per bank, we will guarantee you against loss. So that is definitely a government subsidy that goes to depositors, though it's Main Street depositors. It's people with less money than that in the banking account. So that really hasn't changed. The insured limits have gone up since the crisis, but the nature of a bank deposit really has not changed.
Yeah, I don't think so either. You have a blog, I understand. Peggy's written it upside down for me. Is it Bear Blog? Reading upside down at apparently is bearblog.com.
Yeah, right. Yeah. Well, yes, I do. I write a lot. I write for Fortune. I write for the major newspapers.
Right.
I write for Yahoo Finance. And so when I appear on TV, I'll perhaps put a link to this radio show if you have a site I can link to on the
sure.
Bear Blog site. So if people want to see my recent writings and reviews of the book and things like that.
I'd recommend it. All right, we've got about 30 seconds. Is there something you'd like to leave with the audience? Because you seem like a very positive person. Is there?
Well, I do. I just think, the reason I wrote that book is I want us and future generations, young people, to do better. I think we can do better. We're America. We're all about accountability, succeeding on your own merit, and not by gaming the government or taking advantage of someone else. So I hope the bank inspires us. To be better.
Folks, the place to start it is buy the book. I'll talk to you more about it on the other side of the break. Stay with us.
You have been listening to a rebroadcast of Straight Talk About Money. The market data in this rebroadcast is not current and should not be used for any financial decisions.